Hey folks, it's Ray at DCRamRanker.com here, and today I've got something a little bit different. As you probably saw when you clicked on the thumbnail there, it's 45 minutes long. This video is not a short quickie. We're going with the distance on this one here. And it's something I've been doing for about 10 years. I've done a state of sports technology in some way, shape, or another for nearly a decade, and usually in front of a live audience, and usually at a large event. Historically in the past, it's been at the AMP Plus Symposium, where hundreds of people from the sports technology industry gather, and they kind of figure out how they're gonna work together over the next year. And I talk about all the cases where they've done that well and all the cases where they've done that pretty badly. And the same is true for what I did last week. In this case, for a keynote at the Garmin Developer Summit, where I basically live streamed this presentation you're about to watch to a whole ton of people across the entire sports technology industry. Now, as you'll see in just a moment, I pretty much roast everyone equally here at this one. There's no safe ground for any of the companies if they've done something stupid or if there's areas where I think they can improve. Inversely, I'm also gonna talk about all the good and things that companies are doing that are like, yeah, that's the right direction. So with that, keep in mind, this isn't really like a consumer focused presentation, but I find a lot of people that are into sports tech find it really interesting. And also I'm about to reintroduce myself again because we'll cut over to the actual video from that presentation. Enjoy. Hey folks, this is Ray at DCRamRanker.com here. And today I've got the State of Sports Tech 2020 edition. Now I've done these sort of presentations between the AMP Plus Symposium and then the Garmin Connect IQ Summit and then now the Garmin Developer Summit over the past roughly 10 years. It's been a long time. Unfortunately, this is the first time I've had to do it remotely, where I'm just talking to nothing but a whole pile of screens in front of me and you behind it. But it almost seems somewhat appropriate given I live in the sports tech world. Now, what I want to do here is talk about the industry at large. I don't really want to talk about what Garmin's doing per se, though that may be interesting in the context of today's, you know, virtual conference, but what the players are doing that are good, that are bad, some of the trends that I see, some of the good trends, some of the bad trends, and I'm just going to go through it all from all the players, big and small, and kind of talk about the unique things that I've seen over the past year, which is mostly 2020, but also a little bit of the back half of 2019 or so. Now, for those of you that are not familiar with the site, just a quick kind of starter there, if you will. Started almost 13 years ago, which is a crazy long time ago. And of course, I write in-depth reviews about sports technology. And reviews are the primary driver of the traffic of the site, that is. But it's not the only thing that I focus on. It's also kind of those hands-on look, kind of talking about technology and sports technology and how it fits in general. You can see the stats there. One thing I do want to call, though, is the revenue model. It's the thing that gets the most questions on about the site, especially after these conferences. And the biggest thing to take away is I don't take any money from any of the companies I review, and I send back all the products after I'm done reviewing them. All the revenue from the site comes primarily from affiliate links through things like Amazon, over the last day, Amazon Prime Days, for example, and then a small bit of advertising that is purely contextual based on what you've been looking for out in the interwebs. And I block all the companies that I review as well. So I try to remain as impartial as I possibly can be. Of course, like anyone, you have your preferences. And I talk about those and why I prefer certain things or different things, but I try to do a good job of backing all that up with data. Now, one of the things that's so cool about the site in general is a diverse readership. And you see a picture here of the DCR open house from last December. That was when I have open house every year here, even was twice here in some cases, where people can come and check out everything here in the DCR cave in Amsterdam, including this little set behind me and all that kind of goodness. And then from there, we go out and run or ride or whatever the case may be. And the cool thing when you meet with everyone is that you realize it's not just like people that are always trying to eke out that last second on a track workout, whatever the case may be. It's also people just running their first 5K or people understanding how to use this technology to make themselves more healthy. In fact, if you look at some of my most popular videos on YouTube, they're for things like basic Fitbit tracker. They're for where people want to understand how to use this technology as opposed to just having the technology thrown at them. Now, what are the big overarching trends of sports tech in the 2020, the never-ending 2020 that it may be? First off, it's a huge shift towards kind of the health and wellness data. It's something that we've seen over time. You know, certainly many companies have talked about health and wellness data, and you know, it used to be activity trackers, and then it moved to different stats and stuff like that. But one of the big trends here is how to use that, like almost on the verge of medical. And so we'll talk about that kind of in the realm of COVID-19 in a moment. But sort of that in that range there, and we're seeing a lot of what I would call one-time use type metrics. And by that, I mean things that companies will market as, you know, the next greatest thing, but in reality, most of us will only use it once. ECG is a great example of that, where something that could have tremendous value for a small slice of the population, but for like 98% of us, we're gonna do it once on our wrist and be like, yeah, I'm alive and healthy, great. Now, for that last 1% or even 0.5% or 0.25%, that could literally be the difference between life and death. And so those sort of metrics and those sort of features are tough to balance in that, yes, that thing costs you an extra $100, like in the case of the Fitbit Sense, you're paying essentially $100 for that feature, going from the Fitbit Versa 3 to the Fitbit Sense. Is it worth it? It depends on who you are and kind of what your use case is. The other trend that we're seeing is this shift towards actionable performance data. So in the past, I've talked a lot about cases where we've had all this data coming in, but no real guidance on how to use it. We finally have some actual guidance, finally tying those things together, and it's cool to see. It's not perfect. There are certainly gaps in that, and I'll talk about those in a moment, but it's cool to see those kind of ends meeting in the middle finally, as opposed to just being pile data, no recommendations whatsoever. The other trend that I'm seeing, if we look at in just a moment here, the overall market share, is that the companies that have the biggest app stores for their wearables are the companies that are succeeding the most in the wearables segment. And now some of that's somewhat obvious, of course. You're going to see the Apples of the world, these huge app stores that will kind of go up in there. But you're also going to see cases where there are some companies that you would have thought would have had a vibrant app ecosystem, but didn't necessarily have the underlying technology to make that happen. And therefore, we don't see the developers and we don't see the kind of explosion of apps on those platforms. And we'll talk about that again in just a second. Also seeing a bit of a shift towards the middle price ranges, which I think is cool. It's cool to see that features are going from high-end stuff to middle range stuff really, really fast, way faster than we've ever seen in the past. And then we're also seeing companies focus on the squishy middle of kind of a price bucketing that's really appealing to consumers. And then lastly, I'm seeing what is basically a step backwards for advanced cycling metrics. And essentially, not backwards per se, but a stalling where there was so much progress made in the last couple of years, and it's all just sort of like ground to a halt. And we'll talk about why that is in a moment. Now, of course, the big topic this year is COVID-19. Not this year, every day is a big topic. No matter, you know, every day is a new day in this never-ending world. But I want to talk about what sports tech has done in this realm. And the first thing is what it has done to sports tech, which is the impact on product launches. And now it's not as significant, I think, as some people might think, the consumers might think, if you will. And what I've seen is essentially the companies that were well-oiled machines to begin with went through this with a relatively minor hit to their product schedules. Certainly there were a number of products that were slowed down in release this past spring, but I think as we got to like early summer or so, that machine kind of roared back to life. And for the most part, almost all the products that I'm aware of that were sort of mainstream products have launched, even if just slightly delayed. But what we saw within that is sort of this shift towards features towards kind of COVID-19, but not necessarily like always directly there. For example, we saw Apple introduce their hand washing bit in the Apple Watch. In fact, they just talked about that recently in a podcast. It was kind of interesting saying how that was something they spun up super, super quick. And it's something that, you know, doesn't take like a bunch of medical approvals to do, but could have a truly big impact if you can get people to properly wash their hands as opposed to just ignoring that. But with that, we've also seen companies connecting dots that don't exist. It's connecting dots and saying, oh, this metric over here means you have COVID or don't have COVID, or maybe you might have COVID, or maybe you are asymptomatic, or it's all over the place. And so we have to be a little bit careful of making those ties, because sometimes they simply don't exist, or we don't know they exist yet. I think if we look back in this moment 5 years from now with all the data we have, I'm sure scientists will come up with some incredible insights based on the data we have today, but down the road. But as of today, there's only a handful of metrics that people are kind of reliably pointing to and saying this might actually have an impact or might be a good way to predict things with a relatively high degree of certainty. And of course, the biggest impact, a positive one, I think, is the indoor trend, or the trend towards indoor training. And that's something that we've seen in these platforms surge like 300% plus in just the first few months of the year, in that spring timeframe there, when everybody was kind of locked down. And I think that's something that, you know, certainly that bubble is going to burst to a little bit, but I think people have realized the power of indoor training and the entertainment aspect, not just being a boring thing. And so that's something that I'm really excited to talk about more a little later on. Now, as I mentioned a few slides ago, one of the things that we've seen is sort of this shift. And I think we're seeing a bit of a shift of titans in the industry. And you can see this on this slide from Counterpoint, where they basically show the unit sales in H1 of 2019 compared to 2020. And at first glance, you're like, it's not that big a deal. And of course, you see Apple's now the massive, you know, the market share primarily of wearables, in particular smartwatches in this particular case. And you see the shift, though, where Garmin has gone from being, you know, smaller in that range, basically number three, up to number two. You see Huawei increasing market share. And you see essentially the bigger companies are getting bigger and the smaller companies are getting smaller. So that even that share, though, of the smaller companies, effectively the everyone else bucket, the cats and dogs bucket, is decreasing. You see, in 2019, it was 19% of the market, and now it's only 11% of the market, whereas those other larger players have expanded. However, anytime you see those sort of slides, you need to take a step back and look at the data underneath it. In this particular case, that report from Counterpoint Research, while fascinating, had this little chart below on the left there, which showed the breakout of the most popular SKUs bought in 2020 at this point. And so you see numbered 1 through 5. And number one, Apple Watch Series 5, that made sense. Of course, you know, this before Apple Watch Series 6 was announced. Number two, Apple Watch Series 3, made total sense. Number three, Huawei Watch GT2, I can kind of get that. And number four, Galaxy Watch Active 2, sure, I can get that too. And number five, the what? Wait, hold on, what is that? Emu Z3 4G, you've never heard of that. I never heard that until I saw this particular image there. And I said to myself, what is this thing? So I went on to YouTube and I just looked at there. And I find YouTube is a fascinating way to judge whether or not something is true or not from a product popularity standpoint. And I put that in the search there and you can see the results if you zoom in or something on a screen. But what you really have to know from those that side, that page of the half of the page there, is the fact that there is virtually no content on this in any high ranking content. So you can see the top result there is only, you know, 5,500 views. There's one for 300,000 views, one for 1.9 million, but not really the same product. Another one down below for a couple thousand views. For something that's number five on the list for number of units shipped, how does it have almost no content out there in the web? Doesn't really align. So sometimes you gotta look at these stats and take a step back and realize that they don't necessarily represent the market share you're looking at. So in the case of the Huawei watch, the GT2, that sells incredibly well in certain pockets of Asia, namely China, but has very low sales outside of that. I see, for example, myself, literally zero requests for a review of that watch, none. Whereas the Galaxy Watch Active 2, plenty of requests for that. And I've got, you know, review content out there for that. And the same with the two Apple Watches there. So that's something you want to look at when you're looking at these sort of industry analyst type numbers, is to do a bit of a reality check and make sure that that actually matches what you would think. Now, one of the cool things we've seen is this normalization across companies of features. And I showed this slide a year and a half ago at the first Connect IQ Summit or second Connect IQ Summit. And the X's are the ones that you saw back then. And the red X's now, so the black X's back then, and the red X's are the ones that have been added since then. And you can see this filling in of the gaps. And you can see, you know, Apple filling in like sleep tracking this past summer, SpO2 with the Apple Watch Series 6. You can see Fitbit filling in ECG and SpO2, and Samsung filling in bits, and Suunto filling in bits via the Suunto 7, Garmin filling in bits. And this kind of bingo card gets more and more similar as these companies kind of converge on this core market there of features. Now, of course, beyond that, we get into all sorts of sports features and stuff like that. But it used to be that some of the basics like sleep tracking weren't on an Apple Watch, and some of the basics like music or contactless payments weren't on a Suunto watch. So we're seeing this kind of normalize across the board. And with that normalization, we see this kind of focus on what I call the squishy middle. Essentially, like $199 to $229 is sort of the really sweet spot where a lot of companies are aiming for, but it's really roughly $199 to $299. This is the point where it's always been attractive in the wearable world. We've seen Polar and Suunto especially target that area. We've seen Garmin in the last couple of years target that more with the, you know, Vivo Active 3 kind of realm there, and the Vivo Active series at large. But now we're seeing it more and more, and we're seeing Apple paying attention to it. And so the Apple has essentially defined that base bottom tier at $169 with the Apple Watch Series 3, and then now more recently with the $279 Apple Watch SE. Now, at first glance, you may say that's probably a bad thing for competition, but I actually don't think it is. I think it's causing the rest of the market to pay attention to that price point and drive more features into that price point. So while people will focus on the Apple Watch SE, Everyone else can focus on all the features they can bring at that price point or slightly below it or slightly above it. And we're seeing that from Garmin, we're seeing that from Polar, we're seeing that from even Fitbit, with the Fitbit Versa 3 at $229, for example. And I think that's good for consumers, even if there's just a lot of focus in general on Apple, there's also a lot of benefits that Apple's bringing along with that for focus on this price point and options and opportunities at this price point for consumers to pick up that have just more features than they would have in the past. Now, with that, one of the things I've seen in the last year especially is the realization that screens matter. And this is primarily a realization from the Garmin and the Polar and the Suntos of the world, that people want good screens. Like, it's not just big screens, but pretty screens. And, you know, you can bucketize this into different technologies like AMOLED and LED and all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, people want pretty screens. And it's simple as that. And here are some comments that I just quickly grabbed from YouTube, but just by typing a couple keywords in on reviews I've had over the last while. And you can see there's a focus on having pretty screen. People are sick of non-pretty screen, and it's driving how people and their purchasing decisions. And I think the cool thing though is that technology's finally catching up to that. We're seeing that with something like the Venue SQ or the Venue last year, for example, or Fitbit's Sense or Versa 3, and of course Samsung as well. I mean, there's tons of players in this market that are producing pretty watches that have more features and have longer battery life than they have in the past. And I think as we go into 2021, or the never-ending 2020, however you want to define it, we're going to see that trend continue more. And I think eventually we get to the point where some of the watches that we consider like the hardcore endurance watches that can never have a pretty screen might actually have a pretty screen. And you might actually like it because you realize that, you know, for 99% of the time, or even 100% of your time, you don't really need GPS battery life of 60 hours. Yes, there's a section of the market that will need that, and that may be a small section, but I think there is some compromise to be had there where we can get these nicer screens onto these endurance devices and start taking advantage of that for the vast majority of the market, which again, I think is like 98 to 99% of the market does not need to run continuously for 40 hours. And for that last little bit, I think there's ways that with screen technology and changes that you can go ahead and get to cover those use cases when they do pop up here and there. Now, let's kind of step back to that COVID-19 bit for a second there. And I think there's some interesting areas where companies have leveraged big data for public health. And it's really cool to see. And I think one of the kind of the leaders in that space has really been Whoop. And I think, you know, they way back in February when talking about COVID-19 from a data standpoint or having it or any of that kind of stuff was considered taboo, which I know seems funny sitting here in October. But if you remember way back in February, a lot of people, especially outside of China, didn't want to talk about COVID-19 at all. And the idea that you would toggle something in your app, as you can see right there, that says you have COVID-19 and transmit that to even just an internal database somewhere at another platform was kind of scary to a lot of people. But what we've seen since then is they've really led the way on the data collection and sort of the data analysis from that and figuring out what comes from that. Now, as I said earlier, that doesn't mean all those relationships work. That doesn't mean that just because you have a data point here and data point here, that equals COVID there. And while I might not agree with them on lots of their accuracy things or other aspects of their platform, for this particular silo, I think they've done a better job than really anyone else. Still, there is some cool data here. And I think this chart from Whoop is a good example of that, showing what we've done with our time once you get into lockdown effectively, and showing that people get more sleep. And then another one that has very similar to that shows the rest heart rates drop in a good way. They get lower, if you will. So there is some super interesting data. As I mentioned earlier, I think, you know, 3 to 5 years from now, being able to look back at all these data sets will be incredible for scientists to look at that data and figure out all these patterns that they didn't know exist. And then hopefully down the road, use that data to lessen the impact of another pandemic or lessen the likelihood that a pandemic occurs. Now, with this sort of medical-ish kind of stuff, you see that companies have basically kind of like gone close to the edge and then stopped. So I mentioned Whoop a moment ago and praised them, but at the same time, they haven't actually gone over the edge and saying, hey, here's this data that you have. Here's exactly what you should stop doing today. You should go to the doctor today. That doesn't happen. And I think that's where there's opportunity. I know it's a tough thing. I know there's a lot of like medical red tape around that. But I think you can get even closer to that line before you cross it. And so we're seeing, as I mentioned earlier, those two buckets of data in this realm. One is what I would consider one-time use. In other words, like an ECG functionality that for 99% of the population, use it once, you don't use it again. And then the second bucket is all this data that gets thrown at you without any clarity. I think SpO2 falls into that, where lots of companies from Garmin to Fitbit to Apple and you name it, Withings, et cetera, have done SpO2 data stuff, but without providing clarity on how to use it. And that's even ignoring the accuracy aspects that lie below that there. So for example, we see that no one has bothered to get the SpO2 sensor certified in this entire realm. And as we've seen in the last few weeks, we now know quite clearly why, because it's just not that accurate of a point or a place to gather that data, especially if movement's considered and stuff like that. And then even then, once we have all this data, there's literally zero direction on what to do with it. And I've tried all the companies at wearables and no one says what to do with it other than here's a pile of data. Now, switching topics again, because I'm just gonna go through all the fun topics, so it's not gonna be like a super clean thread through everything here, is recurring fitness revenue. And of course, in the past, we've known this for things like Zwift or Trainer Road subscriptions or paying for Peloton or whatever the case may be, but now we're seeing that expand more and more into offerings. For example, Fitbit's premium service offering, and Apple just announced their Fitness Plus service, which competes more with Peloton than Fitbit's competes more with itself, I guess. I'll get into that in just a second. I think one of the challenges here, though, is finding a balance. And I think we see Apple actually so far potentially pull this off. Of course, the service hasn't launched yet, but at least what they've shown of it makes sense, which is, again, competing with Peloton, competing with that sort of, bringing workouts that you would have normally done at the gym into your home and doing them wherever you want. That's basically carving out a new area that you would have either paid a gym for already or something like that. So you're just moving buckets of money somewhere else versus what Fitbit did with their premium service. And I think why people were kind of so put off by it was essentially charging for things that other companies have already included in their products as a baseline. And I would say looking at Fitbit's health premium offering, about 70% of it or so is probably core functionality that everyone else offers by default. And about 30% of it is additive functionality, things that you're like, yeah, that would be worthwhile paying for, though some of that isn't even available yet. So it's a bit of a tough balance. And I think companies have to be careful in this realm here. So another example being more recently, just in the last couple of weeks, Stride has announced the Running Power Meter, announced their subscription service starting next summer. And I think all these companies have to be careful that when you add subscription services to something, you're not taking away things. And I know at first every company says, we're not taking away. But at the end of the day, most of them actually do. They take away features that they would have given away for free and now are paid. And of course, Strava is a great example of this in the last few months of really focusing on the premium side and basically gutting features out from the non-paying side and on an almost weekly basis. It's impressive or crazy or however you want to phrase it, how many things they've removed that were free and basically taken away and put into the paid bucket. And that's a tough balance. And eventually you might tip that bucket over and find that there's not a lot left in the bottom of it. So what's one of the biggest surprises this year for me? It's actually music. In the past couple of years, like 2017, 2018, and early 2019, we saw like all these new music adoptions within the wearable realm. And a lot of that was driven by Garmin, but with Garmin required the rest of the music industry to cooperate. Garmin can't by themselves convince Spotify to do something, or can't by themselves convince Amazon Music to do something, or can't by themselves convince whoever else to do something. And so those are things where you have to have that music collaboration. But really since essentially the last Garmin Connect IQ Summit, a time frame, so almost like a year and a half, we've seen almost no new announcements in the music realm for wearables. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think one, we've seen all the majors, if you will, most major music players, as well as the major tech companies, the Apples, the Googles, et cetera, of the world, that have started to build their walls up higher and higher around their music empires. In some cases from a legal standpoint, in some cases from a productization standpoint. Even just yesterday, Apple announcing a new lower tier home speaker system or home pod system that would basically eat into the Sonoses of the world. And so with that, again, focusing and tying into their music services. So as a result, there's less of an incentive for these companies to bridge all those partnerships. And as companies like Apple expand their wearables realm even further into new price brackets, like we talked about earlier with the Apple Watch SE, that's gonna reduce the need for them to integrate with other third-party players to expand kind of their product offerings on the wearable side. Now, there is some good news though there, which is one, headphones work better now. If I compare headphone connectivity today to headphone connectivity a couple years ago, it's pretty hard for me to break headphones, like new headphones on new wearable devices in normal use cases. It just works, which is kind of nice. That wasn't the case a couple years ago where everything seemed like a bit of a kind of cluster, if you will. Speaking of things that are also working, performance data. So kind of going more deeper into the performance sports side of it now, we're finally seeing this tying of 24/7 data, so basically the rest of your day outside of workouts, and then workout data. And I've talked about this for years. People that have been watching my presentations on this for years know that I've said for a long time, there was this like glass wall, not a ceiling, but like a wall in the middle where you had your everything else data and your sports data, and those two never really talk to each other. And we're finally seeing that. In the case of Polar, we've seen that last year and a half or so with FitSpark and now the Recharge, where those two things kind of depend on each other. In the case of FitSpark, recommending workouts. In the case of Nightly Recharge, that drives into the workout recommendations. In the case of Garmin, with the latest devices like the 745, now having recovery time depending on different aspects of your day. If you have better sleep, it speeds up your recovery time estimates for the next day. If you have less stress, it helps you on the recovery time. If you have more stress, it hurts you in recovery time. And also the ability to pause training status for kind of general life event. These are all things that just make so much sense, but just simply haven't happened today yet. Another example is what Whoop's done around sort of the visualization of that data. I've talked a lot about Whoop so far in the presentation, which is somewhat funny because if you follow my stuff, you know that I wouldn't recommend buying a Whoop strap at all, primarily because of the accuracy. And so that's a case where they have this tremendous presentation of data that's so, so well done once you start to understand it anyways, and how things, you know, one thing impacts another thing in your day-to-day kind of sports recovery life sort of realm, all from optical heart rate sensor and related data on your wrist. The challenge with that is we see, and this impacts really everyone, is that when your accuracy of the underlying base data is incorrect, the entire house of cards falls apart. And this is what we see in the case of Whoop, where they have this, you know, beautiful house of cards, but with a horrible optical heart rate sensor on the bottom of it. And so that optical heart rate sensor gives bad data and everything else just... Now, I think the good news for them though, is that they've got in some ways the hard part done. I think in this case, the hard part for them and for anyone is that software platform. We see all the majors struggling with that. So hopefully that's something that they can change on the road to kind of resolve. But we've also seen more specific sport improvements and things that are like very niche in a sense, but super cool to me as a sports geeky kind of person. First, we saw less than a year ago, Chorus announced their track mode. That was super cool at a time where everyone has run on a track for years, but there's been no like track specific improvements made. Everyone just looked at their GPS tracks and went, oh, that's horrible. That's just running on a track. And they fixed that, so you've got beautiful tracks. We saw Garmin then come in the last month or so with the 745 doing the same thing. You can see a 745 track mode track GPS track, if that makes sense, on the screen there. I mean, it just looks perfect. It like makes me excited to go to the track just to make a perfect circle, which is somewhat silly. We also saw Suunto, for example, add a safe data page to their watch, essentially a data page with coordinates, but also the distance for how far you were to begin with. So, you know, in some cases you may need to be rescued off the side of the mountain, and those coordinates help your rescuers get exactly to you in the fastest possible way. But in other cases, you may realize that you're actually very, very close to where you start off with, and you just got really, really lost along the way. So a good example of having kind of two ways to see that data that make a lot of sense. And then we saw Core company this past summer announced their body temperature sensor. I was using the Tour de France. And I think in some ways, they're a great example of a tiny company you've never heard of. And 99.999% of the world will never hear of them either. But they have tremendous potential in the sport realm. But more importantly, they leverage the platforms out there and the development hooks and platforms like ConnectIQ or like what Wahoo offers kind of more natively through integrations to better their product. And I think, you know, I talk to companies about integrations with other companies and, you know, smaller companies in particular, bring new products into the market. I say, go to where the platforms are. Don't try to reinvent the wheel. Every time I see a company try to reinvent the wheel on making their own platform, it fails. And in this case, Core went ahead and said, you know what, we're going to go to Garmin and Wahoo because they have the vast majority of the market. And we've got a smartphone app for anyone else that needs it. But that's the main thing. And they've had a tremendous amount of interest. Now, the price is a bit high and that'll get solved over time. But I think that's a great example of leveraging the platforms that exist versus trying to roll your own for no particularly good reason. And last but not least, swimmers. I make a joke about swimmers in every presentation. Every year I do this because swimmers never get anything. They don't get any cool tech. It's just always kind of like sloppy seconds. And Finally, last year, swimmers have got two cool things. One, they've gotten better open water accuracy, like really, really good open water accuracy in swimming in a lot of the watches over the last 6 to 9 months. It's been super, super impressive. And then two, they've got kind of this whole integration going on with the Form swim goggles, which was cool, at both outdoors as well as in pools. And so that's something that I had at least mentioned swimming because I think it is cool to see swimmers finally getting something. Now, while we talked about some things that are doing well, let's talk about a few things that aren't doing terribly well. One is aero sensors, literally just like flatlined. I mean, there's basically all these companies that are working on stuff and all these companies that have done almost nothing since, at least publicly. I know all these companies are working behind the scenes, they're doing tons of work and all the working hard night sort of thing. But in terms of consumer viewable stuff, there's really only a handful of companies. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. And I've said in the past, you know, one, it was way too expensive. Two, it was way too complex. Three, there's way too many ways you can screw it up. But in some ways, I think the easiest way to look at it is my perspective, which is trying to test these darn things. And I told the story a few different places, but a couple, like 18 months ago, I think. So just, I don't know, 18 months ago or so, I went to the specialized wind tunnel lab with a bunch of what I would call really smart aero people, some of the smartest aero people in the industry, to try to test some devices and figure out how we can compare those devices from a like testing methodology standpoint. And we spent essentially the entire day adding things to the whiteboard that we didn't understand properly. Not about like aero in general, but about testing aero devices. And it was a tremendous learning curve. And I think that's one of the core reasons why I've been hesitant to test these devices in more depth, because the more I learn about these devices, the more my head hurts. Not just from understanding the technology, but from understanding all the ways they can fail. And I think that's probably why, I know that's probably why a lot of companies have sort of backed away from introducing their products, because they've realized themselves that there's just way too many ways they can fail. And I think that's, it's tough. I'm not really sure what the path out of that is, other than perhaps technology simply getting better enough over time, or good enough over time, that you eventually have something that's productizable. But right now, I'm not really sure that's it. Still, there are some cool like cycling sensory type things out there. I think we've seen the specialized ANSI integration with Wahoo being one of them for crash detection, where you know the helmet's notifying your head unit properly that you've crashed and can send alerts to friends. That's a good example of integration. It's not perfect, but I think it's a good example of that. But users are really demanding this whole cohesive experience from hardware to platform without data silos. And I think that's where, in the case of Specialized with their helmet crash sensors, that you know, in the past, it was like, yeah, that was interesting. But once they got the Wahoo integration there, that was much more interesting because it became a cohesive experience as opposed to just this wonky silo you had to deal with. So 2020 would not be complete without talking about indoor cycling, because it's just, it's exploded. As I talked about earlier, we saw all the platforms explode, not just Zwift, but everyone. You know, the Ruvies, the Full Gases, the Kino Maps, the Tax Training App, like everyone expanded in dramatically, not just like 10%, 20%, like 300% in some cases. But the funny thing is that we in the sports tech realm that, you know, focused on like high performance sports and all this kind of stuff, forget that the biggest platform player here is Peloton. It's not even close. Like, it's so far bigger than everyone else. It's crazy. In fact, I would even wager, I'm pretty darn sure that Peloton is bigger than everyone else combined, both no matter how you want to slice that user number up. And it's impressive, but it's also cool because it shows the potential of where we can go. And I think it shows, it gives some examples of things that work well and things that don't really work well. And now, of course, with this explosion, we've had this sort of like vaporization of inventory. And as a result of that, people can't get into this whole ecosystem. People can't even buy trainers. I mean, basically trainers have been sold out since February. They'll come in line or come on online for, you know, a few minutes, a day or so, and then they're gone again. The same with indoor smart bikes. They're basically completely gone the moment stock shows up. And so it's been tough for people to get into this entire aspect of indoor training, and they can't actually get the hardware to do it. Now, I think one of the most interesting things about this, though, isn't this explosion of interest from everyone else. It's that there's now a pro cycling, virtual cycling indoor scene that's been effectively validated. We've had many companies over the years that have been trying to kind of break into this, where you get, you know, legit pros that are racing in a virtual realm. And it's not just been Zwift, other companies as well. In fact, earlier this year, really the biggest race of the time, if you remember way back to like March, that was a long, long time ago, Ruvi held the Tour de Suisse, And that's something that at the time was the biggest high profile event on indoor cycling platforms. They had all the pro teams there. And that of course then was followed up by Zwift having the, you know, virtual Tour de France. And I think one of the things that we've learned over the last year and a half is that in some ways the production values are more important than the actual race itself, at least in terms of making this as a sport interesting. If you divide virtual cycling from the rest of cycling and call this a separate sport, then you have to have good production values. Just like anything else on TV, if it's boring to watch, people won't watch it. And the good news is we're seeing production values skyrocket. I did a behind the scenes of how Zwift does their productions or TV productions where they're broadcasting to 80 countries, wherever it is live. And it's fascinating. I mean, they have, in some cases, 140 virtual cameras defined around the Zwift race course on a given route. I mean, crazy impressive stuff. And every single production they do, week by week, gets better and better with each new event series they deal with. And I think it's going to be amazing to look back on this a year from now, just like it is amazing to look now compared to a year ago. It's not even the same level. It's not even the same realm anymore. It's super cool. Still, I worry about a couple things. I know there's UCI Worlds coming up later on this year on Zwift, so in you know, indoor cycling platform, but I'm worried that the bottom's all gonna fall out of this. And I think this is probably the biggest area of bubblicious-ness, if you will, in everything that I've talked about, in that the entire indoor cycling scene right now is predicated on people not riding out doors. Once people ride outdoors, there's zero reason to do legit racing indoors aside from fun, like kind of specialty creative events. But in terms of main major events, the pro cycling calendar just doesn't work like that. It's got things that fill the entire year, save for the time that's set aside for those athletes to recover for a couple months. So they're not going to be able to squeeze in another indoor race somewhere else. Or maybe if they will, it'll be like a one-off, but be very, very small compared to what it's been the last couple months. And so I'm concerned that eventually that bubble is going to pop, and I'm not really sure what's going to happen as a result of that. However, it is clear, though, there are some areas of this entire indoor cycling ship, if you will, that are creaking. In a lot of ways, the indoor cycling realm that we, you know, live on now has been this thing that just wasn't designed to hold what we built atop it. And I think what we're seeing a couple of things that aren't ideal there. One is basically land grabbing. So these exclusivity contracts between hardware makers and software. So we're seeing that, for example, more recently with the steering of in Zwift, that's exclusivity things that are tied to hardware. And it makes these weird, like these areas that just hold back the sport in general. They hold back Zwift, they hold back hardware vendors, they hold back third-party companies doing other things. So I don't really think that's good. But more than that, the graphics just need to get better. And I think one of the things that we've seen, you may have seen, I have a screenshot here of Grand Theft Auto with, you know, Shane Miller, GP Llama kind of demonstrating this just for fun. But what's funny about this is this video here that I screenshotted was a live stream. So it wasn't even like a proper production video, though with high production values, but still it was a live stream. And you can see the graphics there look incredible, but it has 110,000 views on a live stream, which is absolutely bonkers. And of course those weren't all live at the same time, but over time. And it shows tremendous interest and having better graphics in this realm. And I think, you know, these platforms, not just Zwift, but everyone that's doing graphical stuff needs to be looking towards the cloud computing, cloud gaming type platforms on how to host things. Because the future isn't, you know, running these things on high-end machines, like the machine that Llama was using there is, you know, $2,000+ machine. That's not the future. The future is running it on whatever hardware or tablet you have handy, but getting that level of graphics from the cloud. And that's not something I'm not seeing companies focusing on enough. Also not seeing the focus on the teams and the cycling and racing leagues. I know Zwift has just started to roll out some of the racing leagues, but I feel like that's a little bit getting the cart in front of the horse, because in this case, there's this entire clubs and teams element that has to be solved first before you make fake teams to race around. So I think those are areas that definitely need some focus, not just by Zwift. I know I'm picking on Zwift in this particular case, but by really everyone in order to kind of move things forward. And finally, it's probably important to mention why I just talked about, you know, Grand Theft Auto. Keep in mind that is a company that spent $100 million on producing this game that wasn't designed for cycling. So while yes, it looks prettier than Zwift, it's also something that doesn't have any of the other functionality as well. It doesn't have all of the gamification and things like that towards cycling beyond just a couple things that a single developer made. So it's not really the same experience as Zwift, and it's kind of subpar in like 99% of the ways beyond that. So continue on here at power meters. Basically crickets, that's the best way. And I think that's actually all right. There were virtually no new power meter announcements in 2020. Only a handful of the handful that were already in 2019 spilled into 2020 for shipping. For example, the SRMX mount like pedals, power meter pedals there, that's one, but there was basically nothing else. And I think that's because the technology has matured so much that moving the bar to the next step just is really hard to do. And I think most of the companies that focused on increasing accuracy in the meantime and increasing reliability of their platforms instead. And I don't think that's a bad thing. We've also seen virtually no budget players in the last year pop up. We've seen a couple prior to that. We've seen a couple that have made a lot of noise along the way, but not actually produced products. And so I'm hoping that we'll see some of those things change in 2021. I think we will see some things change from the major players in 2021, but this is something that still going to be mostly like more of the same probably for a while. Another thing that we've seen stall is running power. And I talked about this a couple years ago being stalled. And now I think it's still definitely stalled. And there was a bunch of reasons for that in the past, but they're mostly the same reasons as today. Number one reason, the biggest one, is simply that Garmin, the biggest player in the space, doesn't have native wrist running power, meaning having running power directly from your wrist without requiring any other sensors, Coros and Polar Dew. I think that's single-handedly the biggest reason running power isn't taking off, because the majority of people can't get it on their watches without having something else. And then two, there's all these aspects that tie into having native running power, like structured workouts and stuff like that, that aren't available on most platforms without add-ins. And then three, for those sensors that are available, they're usually kind of expensive. You know, on the low end, $60 if you have a Garmin watch and you have an existing sensor that supports it, or existing watch that supports a new sensor, up to $200 for a Stride sensor. And even then, there's still all these caveats, and it's still pretty easy for me to break this technology. I did it more recently with the Coros Pace 2 and the Stride sensor on a simple track workout in the rain. So those are just kind of too many cracks in the pavement, if you will, for this technology to really kind of expand quickly into the marketplace. Okay, so as I'm getting definitely over time here, or running out of time, or whatever the case may be, just like I always do if you watch these presentations, a couple of challenges for the industry and a couple of kind of thoughts on how to go from there. Number one is there's still way too much data coming in that's non-actionable data from day zero. So companies announcing products and basically going out and saying, here's this data, we wanna see what people make of it and you know what comes of it. And that's cool to a point. Like, I think that's great to throw data at, as I talked about earlier, and let scientists figure it out 3 to 5 years later. But if you're marketing that is the core of your marketing message, that you've got this new metric that's really important, but aren't actually telling people how to use it, that's not super cool. Just simply saying someone else will figure it out, yeah, that's just passing the buck. It's not really a great thing. Next, subscription fatigue. I think that's going to be a core issue for 2021, where I think there's just so many people and companies trying to throw subscriptions at you from a fitness standpoint that I'm not really sure it's gonna work out great long-term there for consumers or companies. And number three, continuing to make the data portable. So something that back like 5 to 10 years ago, I talked about in the presentations, and the industry got really good at it. Like the industry got really, really good at making data in the standard file formats, DCX, FIT, et cetera, for sport data. But now we have all these new data types like SpO2 and ECG and et cetera, but no containers that are industry agreed upon for how consumers can trade that data between platforms. And so we've got all this new data and zero integration or compatibility or portability of that across platforms. And I think that's kind of a bummer. We've gone from so, so good to not at all good anymore. So that's something I'm hoping that the industry can resolve. So I think going forward into 2021, some of the biggest opportunities are giving clear guidance, clear recommendations, and not shying away from recommendations, not shying away from providing insight into how someone should be using that. If you're right like 98% of the time and it's not life-threatening, I think being wrong for 2% of the users is all right in some cases if it's benefiting the vast majority of people. Again, you shouldn't have like bad recommendations all the time, but I think stepping out of that box and saying this is probably the right way to address this issue is a good thing. I think that's what the point of having technology there to enable kind of us from a digital athlete standpoint. And then two, finding the right niche. I think I see too many companies sometimes trying to boil the ocean. Find the right niche and find how you can integrate with your users. And obviously this is a developer conference, and so that's kind of like a core goal here, but leverage those platforms. Don't try to build your own platforms to boil the ocean on top of that. Leverage what's always there. And then last but not least, as I always say, I think in general, if you simply just make cool shit, people will buy it. It's as simple as that. People will clamor towards your products when you make cool stuff, and they'll want to buy it, and they'll want to buy the next version, and they'll want to support you as a company. So with that, I will call it the end, as I'm slowly losing my voice here. It's the longest I've talked straight in a while. I appreciate the time of watching this, and hopefully you found it interesting and useful, whatever the case may be. And I look forward to maybe next year being able to present in person somewhere, back when life has hopefully normalized just a little bit more.